This is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. Malcolm Turnbull has been promising to put innovation at the centre of his government's agenda, and today we'll see what that is actually going to mean. In a major innovation statement, the government will announce a $1 billion innovation and science package that will include a $100 million boost for the CSIRO. There'll be more than 20 new measures across 11 portfolios, including exemptions from capital gains tax for start-up investors and changes to bankruptcy and immigration law. From Canberra, Peter Donald reports.
Scientists around Australia are excited about what today's innovation statement might bring.
It is very, very good to have this as a primary focus of the new government.
Professor Les Field from the Australian Academy of Science is hoping for funding that's long-term and secure, including for major pieces of scientific equipment, at the moment being funded for 1 or 2 years at a time.
This is just not the way to run a major piece of infrastructure. I mean, you wouldn't run an airport or a sea terminal, again, major pieces of what I call physical infrastructure, on a 1 or 2 year funding cycle.
He warns against too much focus on commercial outcomes rather than pure research, pointing to the Australian invention of Wi-Fi.
When it was invented, it wasn't as if people were trying to invent Wi-Fi. They were actually astronomers trying to make their computers talk to each other. The basic research is what really does give you major breakthroughs and often the biggest impact.
Yeah, we're terribly excited.
Peter Brad from a peak group called Startups Oz also has high expectations. Australia, he says, ranks 81 out of 141 countries for innovation efficiency and could do much better.
We're looking forward to the government using tax, which is a well-known incentive that's worked really well in the UK and other countries, to help move those investment dollars out of property and other asset classes that aren't of national importance. Tech startups and innovation is really critical to the Australian economy.
Malcolm Turnbull and Christopher Pyne, the Innovation and Science Minister, will unveil the plans at the CSIRO in Canberra. Labor's Ed Husic points out it's one of a long list of important national science and research institutions that's lost millions of dollars of funding under the coalition, the CSIRO alone losing 1,400 jobs.
As much as we welcome the fact that the government is making this innovation statement, it really is important for them to spell out how they are going to repair all the damage caused by cuts that a lot of the ministers that will be there today were quite happy to cheer on in two successive budgets. They've hyped it up. We have to see if the expectation will match reality. So we'll wait with, as many people are, with bated breath to see if the innovation statement actually lives up to all the hype.
Labor's spokesman on digital innovation and startups, Ed Husic, and Peter Donald with that report. Well, the business community says it's counting on the innovation statement delivering a strategy that will work in the real world to counter the end of the mining boom, the ageing population, and the end of car manufacturing in Australia over the next few years. The chief executive of the Australian industry group, Innes Willicks, is speaking with our business editor, Peter Ryan.
Well, Peter, this is going to be a crucial statement. It's as important as the tax statement that the government will release, we expect, next year. It's really important in sending a signal to business and the wider community that we are serious at all levels of government and industry about developing a culture for the future.
There's always the risk, though, that these sort of statements contain big picture statements that are short on tactics. So this time the rubber really needs to hit the road.
Oh, that's absolutely right. There won't be too many second chances here. There's a lot of attention being paid to this statement right across industry from different industry sectors. And as we all know, we're seeing the mining boom wind back. We're about to go through a massive transformation with the wind down of the auto sector, which has provided a lot of innovation across industry in terms of skills and management capability now for decades. We're seeing the global economy continue to try to get out of a downturn. So there's going to be significant pressure on our economy in the years ahead. We're talking about major demographic challenges in Australia, so this statement is going to be crucial.
One key feature that's been flagged is keeping top innovators and their ideas here in Australia, turning the brain drain back into a brain gain.
California, and particularly Silicon Valley, is one of the biggest hubs of Australian expats, and you wonder why they're going there. That's because they're being lured there because there is an innovative culture in Silicon Valley. And we have to find ways, if not to stop them going, and people can move around, but to attract them back as well, to ensure that they want to work here, that they find that this is an open and willing environment, that they can finance their ideas, that they're not restricted through things like our bankruptcy laws, which make it really impossible for someone to try an idea and fail. So we need a bit of a cultural shift there.
Tax is already at the centre of a major debate here in Australia, particularly around the GST. But when it comes to attracting innovators and keeping the ideas here, what's the single biggest tax barrier?
One is the corporate tax rate. That's very difficult. But certainly we need to do more in terms of encouraging business to invest in R&D. So perhaps the first thing the government could do would be to take the proposed cuts to the R&D tax benefit that are now before the Parliament off the table. That would send a very clear signal to business of the government's intent that they are serious about retaining talent in R&D in Australia.
Malcolm Turnbull is now 3 months into the Prime Minister's job. So how important is this statement going to be in creating more certainty and stability at the national political level?
These are going to be crucial long-term issues for Australia if we are to develop that economy of the future that the Prime Minister talks about.
Chief Executive of the Australian Industry Group, Innes Willicks, with our business editor, Peter Ryan. For only the third time in his presidency, Barack Obama will give an address to the nation from the Oval Office. He's expected to directly confront American fears of terrorist attacks and to promise to use every single aspect of American power to destroy Islamic State. Republicans and Democrats have called for the president to be more aggressive in his campaign against the terrorist group. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
President Barack Obama's last address from the Oval Office in 2010 marked the end of combat operations in Iraq. Later today, he'll give another address to mark the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil since September 11. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
I think what you're going to hear from him is a discussion about what government is doing to ensure all of our highest priority, the protection of the American people.
The San Bernardino massacre has raised fears in the American public that more attacks are possible.
I think he'll talk about the actions that we've taken, not just since 9/11, but since Paris, to help keep the American people and American interests safe. You may hear him call on Congress to review measures and take action as well.
The terror wrought by what appears to have been a self-radicalized attack in San Bernardino is palpable. Now, both sides of politics are warning that the longer Islamic State persists, the likelihood of a Paris-style planned attack in the United States increases. Republican presidential candidate Senator Lindsey Graham.
And there is a 9/11 style attack coming to America, and I can tell you who's planning it. The leaders of ISIL, and I can tell you where they're at. They're in Raqqa, Syria. So for God's sakes, Mr. President, change your strategy, come up with a ground force to go in and destroy the caliphate before we get hit here at home.
Senior California Democrat Adam Schiff has also called for the president to dramatically change his strategy and become more aggressive in his destruction of Islamic State.
We're not immune from a Paris-style attack. They aspire to attack us that way. If they're given more time and the luxury to plan and plot, they may have the capability of doing that. So it has a very direct link to our security.
In previewing the speech, the White House says the president will say that in attempting to destroy Islamic State, the US must continue with its values of justice, equality and freedom. In a widely reported speech, the head of the self-styled world's largest Christian university, Jerry Falwell Jr., said if more of his students carried a gun, they could end those Muslims before they walked in. And as the crowd cheered, he added, "Let's teach them a lesson if they ever show up here." He later clarified after the speech that he meant those Muslims that were Islamic terrorists. The Democrat congressman who represents San Bernardino, Pete Aguilar, says he's concerned about a backlash.
We need to come together. Muslims in the San Bernardino County community and throughout this country are outraged at what took place here. So I think that's the important lesson, is that we don't buy into the continued Islamophobic message that has been going on by some folks on TV. We need to make sure that we move forward as a community, and San Bernardino County Muslims, I know, stand against this horrific act.
The guns that were used in the massacre in San Bernardino were reportedly purchased legally and either given or sold to the attackers. The president also again expected to address gun control in his address. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
The government of Thailand says it is still a safe holiday destination for Australian tourists, despite reports of 10 Syrians with links to the Islamic State group entering the country. Details of a Russian intelligence report warning Thailand about the possible terrorists were leaked to media, but the Thai government says there is no imminent threat and is playing down the leaked report. Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane reports from Bangkok.
The memo is marked secret and urgent. It was sent in late November from Thailand's police intelligence unit to various investigative branches and later leaked to the media. The memo cites intelligence from Russia's Federal Security Service warning the Thai government that 10 Syrian members of the Islamic State group slipped into Thailand in October and are planning to attack Russian targets. Anthony Davis is a Bangkok-based analyst with security group IHS Jains.
In the aftermath of the downing of the Russian airliner in Sinai, the FSB would be, to put it bluntly, in panic mode. They would be looking at areas of Russian vulnerability globally, and particularly areas that concern large numbers of civilians.
The police memo says two of the Syrians disappeared from sight, but four of them travelled to Pattaya, two to Phuket, and two to Bangkok. Anthony Davis says this target-rich environment is one of several security vulnerabilities in Thailand.
We have very large numbers of Chinese, very large numbers of Russians, of Westerners, of Australians. You name it, they're here. So it's a target-rich environment. Secondly, Thailand labours under the baggage of being still a permissive environment, and that involves two particular areas. One is official corruption, and the other is the presence in this country of transnational criminal groups. And both of these areas of vulnerability were underscored in the terrorist attack at the Erawan Shrine in central Bangkok on the 17th of August this year.
The bombing outside the busy Erawan Shrine in downtown Bangkok killed 20 people and injured more than 120 more. It's being blamed on extremists linked to the Muslim Uyghurs of Western China, but many questions remain about the attack. There are just as many questions about this recent Russian intelligence report.
What we do not know is, are they planning to pull off some sort of attack in the fairly near future over the holiday season, for example, or are they looking to establish a longer-term presence which would give them the opportunity to establish connectivity in Thailand that might eventually enable them to source explosives or weapons and what they would need to carry out a more sophisticated terrorist attack?
The Thai government is playing down the leaked memo, saying it's part of normal intelligence sharing. Major General Virachon Sukhothaibathipak is the deputy spokesman for Thailand's military government.
I can assure our foreign visitors to come to Thailand that Thailand is still a fair place to come to visit.
With the Thai economy hurting at the moment, tourism is becoming increasingly vital. And the last thing Thailand needs is the threat of Islamic State operatives lurking around the bars and beaches that bring in so much foreign cash. This is Liam Cochran in Bangkok for AM.
And this is AM around Australia, where it's 23 minutes past 7. The federal government and the opposition have announced the makeup of an advisory council to consult on the best way of recognising Aboriginal Australians in the Constitution. The announcement was delayed when Tony Abbott was replaced as Prime Minister. Megan Davis is the director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales and one of the members of the council. She joins me now. Megan Davis, good morning.
Good morning.
Why is a referendum council needed? Has momentum toward a referendum stalled?
I think so. I think there's a lot of agreement on that. There's been approximately 4 processes in the past 5 years, and none of them have had any decisive response from either, really, of the political parties. And so I suppose this new council is the next iteration of this very complicated and very complex process toward constitutional reform.
And this is a bipartisan effort. Do you expect that this is actually going to increase the momentum and bring it back to be an important and central part of the debate?
Yeah, I think actually, you know, bipartisanship is important at the ballot box of a referendum. But it is important that along the way we have some disagreement on and contest of ideas about what the proposal should look like. And I think that that's there. I think Labor has a kind of different vision to what the government has on this. And I suppose the work of the council will be able to, in some ways, get a sense from Aboriginal people and then the Australian people what it is that they think is appropriate in terms of reform.
And how do you expect it will operate?
Well, we're not 100% sure because we're having a meeting next week to work that out, but the council will be working with a group of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to lead Aboriginal designed conventions to discuss proposals. Well, actually, there's a first step, and that is do Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people want to continue with the process, and what might that look like? Because, you know, there is somewhat of ambivalence towards this process in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. And one of the reasons that Patrick Dodson, Noel Pearson and Kirsty Parker and I asked for Aboriginal-specific conventions was because we had to go back and have a conversation with communities about, you know, where we're going.
Well, why is there an ambivalence toward this idea among the Aboriginal community? You'd think that this would be something that they would embrace as a whole.
Well, it depends on what we're embracing. I mean, we're only talking about a concept at this point, which is recognition. That's not very clear what that means. If recognition is something akin to symbolism or minimalism, then that's unlikely to get the support of the Aboriginal community. And that is because the Aboriginal community is very universal on this point. If the reforms aren't going to make a significant difference to their lives, if it's not going to advance the legal status or position that they have currently, then it's a huge amount of political capital and money to expend on something that's not going to take us forward.
So some think constitutional recognition is not enough.
Well, we don't. I think the question is an important question. What does constitutional recognition mean? Recognition in terms of legal and political reform actually sits on a spectrum. So there's the weakest form of recognition is something akin to just a few lines of acknowledgement. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's more substantive reforms, the kind that you see in Canada, the US, New Zealand. Now, part of the role of these conventions is to work out where recognition lies on that spectrum. And I think one of the problems with the kind of delay, as you noted at the outset, is the ambiguity over the term recognition.
Hmm. Tony Abbott famously marked himself as the Prime Minister for Indigenous Affairs. This council was indeed a Tony Abbott idea. What are Malcolm Turnbull's views, as far as you know?
I don't know. All I know is that he knows a lot about referendums. He knows a lot about the risks associated with referendums. He knows when we took symbolic or weak form recognition to the Australian people the last time on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, they voted no. So he knows this terrain well, and I look forward to the guidance that he's going to provide the council on this.
And is he still committed to 2017? Is that still the goal that you're looking at?
2017. If you have a look at the words of Tony Abbott, he didn't even really specifically commit to that. He said, "I know there's a lot of pressure for that day." And look, it's not clear in the community. Some people think that's fine, and a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people think 1967 as a significant Australian achievement should be left alone, to be a day that you commemorate the 67 referendum and not include, you know, a potential referendum on that date. So I think at this point, in terms of deadlines, I think we just have to get the model right. We have to get communities back on side. Deadlines are important, but I think 2017 was a contrived date in the first place, and I'm not sure it's useful or helpful because that, as you suggest, is a very quick timeline if that's what people are focused on. But I don't think we should focus on the date before we've even come up with a model.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Megan Davis, the Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales and one of the members of the Advisory Council for Recognise Australia. And to finance now, quickly, the Australian share market is set to open higher after a strong close on Wall Street at the weekend. Oil is lower at just under $40 a barrel, and the Australian dollar is buying 73.4 US cents. I'm Michael Brissenden. That's the program for today. It's 7:30.